Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with David Lipofsky, who'll be giving us an update on the AODA's work concerning Bill C-81. Tell me a little bit about what's been happening with Bill C-81 as far as the AODA is concerned.
Well, as of the time we are speaking, Bill C-81, the proposed Accessible Canada Act, has passed second reading in Parliament and will be proceeding to a standing committee for hearings and clause-by-clause debate. This is when the public gets a chance to give suggestions on any changes needed, and when politicians can bring forward proposed amendments and they're debated and voted on. And before I go any further, I want to encourage everybody to get together, get ready to write down an email address I'm about to give everyone, because it's absolutely essential to everything I'm going to say, and I want to make sure I get it in there. And the email address is for the Standing Committee of the House of Commons that's going to hear this. It's H-U-M, like Michael A, H-U-M-A at parl.gc.ca. So it's H-U-M-A at parl, parl.gc.ca. Because we're encouraging people to write that committee and to support the brief of the AODA Alliance, which calls for reforms to the bill.
So what types of reforms are you hoping to work in?
Well, on the 27th of September, we released a very detailed brief, probably the most detailed brief out there, bringing forward a series of specific reforms. In each case, we quote what the bill says, we explain where it's good and where it's got problems, and then we make specific recommendations. So we're encouraging people to simply write and say, we support the AODA Alliance brief. And if you want to see the brief, which I'm going to summarize for you right now, just go to aodaalliance.org/Canada, and you'll see a link to download and read it. And it includes a summary if you don't want to read the whole thing. There's a five-page summary right up front. There are a few major concerns we have. The bill is a good start, and we commend the federal government both for the work they've done on it and on bringing it forward, but it needs significant amendments to be an effective law, to be a good law, to live up to the rhetoric we've heard of what the government commendably is trying to achieve. The first thing is it's got to set the goal of full accessibility for Canada by a specific deadline. It just says it aims to achieve the progressive realization of a barrier-free Canada, and that means it could take us two millennia, and most of us, I don't think, are going to live that long. So it should set an end date. We're not specifying what end date the federal government should pick. We're leaving it to them to try to sort that out as between us and the obligated organizations. Ontario gave 20 years, which we thought was a reasonable call back in 2005. It's worth setting a date. The second thing we say is the bill gives the federal government a number of very good powers to take action on accessibility, but it doesn't actually give them any duties to use those powers. So the bill could give the government those powers, they could never use any of them, and nothing will change. So we call in our brief for the government to turn these powers into duties and to set dates by which they got to be exercised. The government can create accessibility standards to specify what federally regulated organizations should do. It should specify that they must set those standards and when they've got to do it by. And we give lots of examples. The third problem with the bill is it's unnecessarily complex and confusing. It splits and splinters the implementations of the bill over multiple agencies. When it comes to making federal standards, which are really important regulations to tell people what they got to do, it splinters those between three different standard-making bodies. The federal cabinet can make some. The Canadian Transportation Agency can make some. The Canadian Radio and Television and Telecommunications Commission, CRTC, can make some. That's going to be totally confusing, and obligated organizations are going to want one set of rules made by one body, not, and people with disabilities don't want to have to run around the country lobbying three different organizations to get what we need. It splinters the enforcement of the bill among those organizations and one more, the federal tribunal that regulates federal employment. That's totally confusing. It's going to require people with disabilities to run in circles. And it, in doing that, it's giving a bunch of powers to the Canadian Transportation Agency over transportation and the CRTC over broadcasters and telecom. And the problem there is those two agencies have already had power in that area. Their track record is completely insufficient, and they tend to lean too much in favor of the industries they regulate, not people with disabilities. We need these powers in the hands of organizations who are going to be trying to do the best they can for people with disabilities, not just the industries that they regulate and who they have a revolving door relationship with, and people coming from those industries to work at the commission and then go back to the industry. It doesn't work.
So
the other two problems, I'll tell you really fast, is the bill gives the federal government a whole bunch of powers to create exemptions, to pass regulations, to narrow the scope of the bill. We don't like that. It could weaken the bill at any time in the future. And finally, the bill doesn't use all the levers of power that the federal government should use. It should require the federal government to ensure that whenever federal money is spent, it has accessibility strength, that nobody can use federal money to create or perpetuate barriers against people with disabilities.
I'm wondering, when you mentioned the powers being divided, there's no guarantee that the government's left hand will know what its right hand is doing in regards to people with disabilities.
Well, anybody who's worked in government, and I worked in the provincial government for a third of a century, know that when you divide up powers between different over the same subject matter between different ministries or departments, it's exactly what you're talking about. It slows progress. It weakens effectiveness. Nobody has the ultimate handle on everything. But the other thing that it does is it leads to possible inconsistent regulations or uneven implementation. The different process for enforcement at the CRT, the CTA, and the new accessibility commissioner that they're commendably creating is going to make it very confusing with people with disabilities to know where do I go if I've got a problem, who do I talk to, what's the procedure, what are the deadlines. We want one set of rules, we want one-stop shopping, and it's no solution to just say, well, there'll be one door to file your complaint and then the government will sort out where it goes. Because that's just the door getting in. That doesn't harmonize what goes on when you get in. And it doesn't solve the problem that why should we have to go complain to the Canadian Transportation Agency, who's done some things on accessibility, but they've had powers to act for years, and their track record is not an impressive one.
So
that's why we've needed this legislation, to fix what hasn't worked till now. And going back to the people who've done an inadequate job in the past is not a formula for better success in the future.
So you don't want these agencies passing the buck, saying, oh, not my department, take it up with this group who may or may not have any concept.
And we also don't want to, if you're bringing a transportation complaint, you want to bring it to a body that's going to look at it from a strong accessibility perspective, not a body that's unnecessarily leaning in the direction of the transit providers. But, the, you know, just because I know time is running out, people listening to this may wonder, what can they do to help? This is all technical. I'm not into all these details. If you go to aodaalliance.org/Canada, you'll see tips on what you can do. But just a one-sentence email to the government that says, we support the AODA Alliance brief on Bill C-81 would help us a great deal. And the email to write is the one I gave before, huma@parl.gc.ca.
I will get on doing that myself in the near future, and I'd encourage my listeners to do the same, and like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
And if people do write, we'd love it if you'd copy us so we know who's been supporting us and we can keep track of that and be able to remind the federal government of how many voices support us. And our email address, where we always welcome feedback, is aodafeedback@gmail.com. That's aodafeedback@gmail.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Karen Luker from Ottawa Therapy Dogs. So tell me a little bit about Ottawa Therapy Dogs.
So Ottawa Therapy Dogs was created in 1999 by a retired nurse who wanted to share the love of dogs with vulnerable individuals within our community. So we have just under 100 volunteers who are visiting approximately 60 facilities within the Ottawa area. We visit nursing homes, hospitals, we have a school program, we go into palliative care units, rehabilitation units, et cetera.
So when you say vulnerable individuals, that's not just for use as a guide dog would be. This would include things like mental health.
Exactly. So we really aim to reach individuals who have either physical or mental health challenges, or both. And we're a little bit different from service dogs. So volunteers visit with their own dogs, and the dog, you know, lives with the owner, and the team goes out to the facility that they're assigned to, and they will visit with, you know, anywhere between 1 and 10 individuals for the hour and a half to 2 hours that they're there. So the team is not assigned to a specific individual, but rather is visiting in order to bring comfort and you know, many other benefits through the therapy visits.
So how do you go about reaching out to those who could potentially benefit from this contact?
That's an interesting question. We actually don't have to do much reaching out. The facilities reach out to us. I think in the early days, Marilyn probably, you know, did a lot of legwork in identifying appropriate facilities and reaching out to them as a new organization, but we're a well-known charity within the Ottawa area, and so the requests come into us, and we're actually unable to fulfill all of the requests that we get.
So are there any challenges in the work itself, matching up the right dog with the right person?
There are lots of challenges. I think probably the biggest challenge that we have is trying to fill all of the needs that there are here in Ottawa. If you think about, you know, the very strong bond between a dog and a human being, just about anybody can benefit from a visitation. So we have, for example, we have a program at Carleton University where we go in and visit students who are undergoing examinations. And we might have a lineup of 200 students to see one of our four or five dogs, and we have a 1-hour session. So that's probably one of the biggest challenges that we encounter, is trying to meet all of the needs.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with Ottawa Therapy Dogs, has there been any success moment that really stands out for you?
My gosh, I could write a book. So I visited with my miniature dachshund, Go-Go, for 8 years in a palliative care unit. And I cannot tell you the number of times that I've been able, or Go-Go rather, has been able to reach someone who has either not been interested in any kind of interaction with anyone on the unit. We've seen people who have been in a tremendous amount of pain be able to reduce, the perception of pain and their anxiety related to the pain by the mere presence of the dog, and by focusing their energy on the interaction with the dog. Research actually shows that the fact that you're petting a dog will reduce your heart rate, your respiration rate. There are so many documented benefits on many, many levels, so not just physical, but emotional, social. We see increases in communication. You can imagine it extends into psychological, spiritual, etc.
So have you ever seen a case where a therapy dog was used to reach a child, for example, who was otherwise uncommunicative?
Absolutely. And I'll perhaps speak to our READ program. So READ stands for Reading Education Assistance Dog. And so these dogs and their handler go into school and work with children who have been identified as struggling readers. So what ends up happening is the child will be pulled out of the classroom to work with the dog, and the premise is that the child will be practicing their reading, but at the same time will be doing it with someone who is a non-threatening listener. So the child kind of forgets that there's an adult there, and the interaction is really all about them getting in a practice session with, a fluffy companion who won't point out their mistakes, who, will just accept them for who they are. And to specifically address your question, as you can imagine, in the school system, we see a number of different children who have a variety of needs. Excuse me for a second. So we may be working with children who have learning disabilities, who have anxiety issues, who have autism, and often those children, may have some difficulties with either their self-esteem, with their ability to interact with others. And so the dog really just helps to bridge that gap. The dog is really there to help stimulate conversation, to help really just turn it into a fun, sought-after interaction that, all of the kids are envious of. And so the child who's been traditionally pulled out or singled out for either their particular challenges or their disability or the fact that they're attending a remedial program suddenly becomes a child who gets to go to the favorite program in the school.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem at all. It was my pleasure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Safe Lancer app is an essential tool to your safety at the University of Windsor. The app will alert you to any emergency situations on campus and provide instant access to campus security resources. You can access a virtual walk home, allowing campus police or even a friend to follow you online to your destination. Chat with a campus police dispatch directly via the app, make reports of suspicious activity, and access on and off campus support services. You can also check the crime map to see campus and Windsor police reported crimes in the area. Be a Safe Lancer on the UN campus and download the Safe Lancer app, available for Apple and Android devices.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Karen Luker and David Lipofsky. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Rachel Gorman from York. So tell me a little bit about what's expected of a student who goes into critical disability studies from an administration standpoint.
That's a great question. I think what we expect from students, we really tailor our expectations to where the students are coming from and where they're trying to go with it. Because we're interdisciplinary, we have students coming from anything from theater to rehabilitation and anything in between. And so we do have a set of core requirements that everyone takes together, but there's a really amazing kind of collective transformation that happens through that process. So a master's student, it's a one-year program. If someone comes in as a master's student, they would be taking a course in disability law. They would be taking a course in methodology, learning how to do research from a critical perspective. And they would also be taking a year-long seminar that outlines disability studies as a field. So everybody is getting basic knowledge of the field they're entering into and then that they're going to contribute to. Students find it challenging, and mostly because the ideas are challenging. And so for some, it's a really revelatory experience where they start to think critically in new ways about disability and social justice and policy and law. So, and so the other expectation is then after going through this 8-month process of coursework, there is then supported in doing their own major research paper.
So do you find that when the students engage in their own research that the faculty tends to learn anything new about disabilities themselves through this research?
Oh, absolutely. Every student project is it's a real joy to supervise because we do always learn something new because it's always coming from the unique perspective of the student, and they're designing the project. So we're either learning more about their own life experience, their activism, or a really interesting kind of angle on a question that we hadn't thought of before. So they also have the opportunity to work with, if they're a master's student, they bring in two faculty, and one might be a core faculty in disability studies, but one might be from any of the programs across York, so because it's interdisciplinary. And for doctoral students, of course, they've got three faculty members on their committee. So we do get to learn across the disciplines from all kinds of critical perspectives and then from the student in terms of how they're thinking through different problems and questions, often connected to their own life experience and work life.
So are there any challenges in the core information that they have to get in there, the stuff they need to learn?
Is it challenging to learn it? Yes. I think the ideas can be difficult and unsettling. I think people are kind of also exhilarated by it, but it's a lot of work. It's quite intense. Students are reading a really high volume each week as they're kind of going through this process. They're really being challenged to read it and digest it and discuss it with their colleagues. And they're also being challenged in terms of writing. What is important to note about the program is that we do very much think about access and accommodation as central to our principles and our foundation. And so there have been a lot of really innovative ways that students have approached doing their work or accommodated their work, lots of creative ways that we have faculty, as faculty, have learned to support students. And we also are very familiar with all of the kind of broader York policies around accommodation. So, you know, on the one hand, it is very challenging. On the other hand, we are very, we're thinking very broadly and inclusively about how students might complete the work to best kind of highlight everyone's strengths, everyone's process, and to really honor how people work differently.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time at York within CDS, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Oh, some amazing successes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. one thing that springs to mind immediately is I was supervising a master's student whose name is Rabia Khoder, and she's actually currently an Ontario Human Rights Commissioner. Pretty much the week after she finished her major research paper and defended it, she organized an event at the Ontario Legislature when David Only was the Lieutenant Governor and brought together the community. She had business leaders, spiritual leaders from the Muslim community. She brought them together. She outlined her research, which happened to be on the need for accommodating people labeled with intellectual disability in the Muslim community in the GTA. And by the end of the event, she had commitment to open an entirely new program. So she kind of fundraised an enormous amount of money. So that really stands out as the fastest kind of thought to action. But I think for most of our students, even sometimes change takes a really long time. And so even hearing from students who finished 5 years ago or 10 years ago, when they come back and tell us what kind of work they're doing in whatever their field is, you can see the enormous changes that they're bringing where they go, wherever they go afterwards with their ideas and with their critical perspectives.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Personally, I find it no surprise that students would come back to those who educated them in disability studies. Fact is, we all can stand that growth in our understanding. And once you're out there, once you're on the leading edge of making the world a better place for people with disabilities, fact is, it takes a lot of heart and a lot of support to keep that momentum going. The truth is, you're going to have some questions from time to time. You're going to need a sounding board, someone to say, this is my idea, can it be done? And the fact is, the people who made you the great success you've become, odds are they're going to want to look at your work and say, of course I want to be involved, of course I want to help. Your success is an example what we helped you do. Having the tools, my friends, is not necessarily unto itself enough. A person can learn all the technical facts concerning disability life that there are, but if you don't have the heart for it, the drive, the ambition, and the creative thinking to say, we can make this world better, it doesn't mean nearly as much. It comes with a lot of determination and a lot of character. The fact is, those who serve the best in the disability community are the ones who connected to their life experience. They're the ones who say, I understand why this has to be better. It's a very human thing. It's not cold facts on some data sheet somewhere. No, these are real men, women, and children being affected. We owe it to them as a society to give them our best so they can achieve their best. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.